The nation marked Independence Day, but it came amidst political turmoil. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Country's voters are being bombarded with images ranging from a president who lashes out at his critics, the rage of the resistance from both Democrats and former GOP leaders. Some say it is even an inflection point in the political history of the country. Author Glenn Aparicio Perry says there may be a way out of this crisis in his new book, Original Politics, Making America Sacred Again. He writes that we have lost sight of the Native American traditions that so influenced the founders of the country. We have him on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Don. Thank you so much for having me on.
So I want to turn, by the way, to some news, which is that the Washington team, the Redskins, apparently it looks like they're going to change their name. Cleveland Indians also doing the same. I was just interested in getting your reaction to that development, first of all.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, Redskins is originally a term that's very much racially charged, and I used to joke that they could keep the name if they just changed the logo to a potato, you know, like a red potato. But I think that's a good thing. And at the same time, we have to be aware that there's this battle back and forth between the forces of awakening consciousness with regard to sensitivity for race, and then there's always the backlash that comes from the other side that actually, you know, our president now will try to take advantage of to a large degree. We have to be careful not to go overboard, but I think that one's an obvious one. You know, you wouldn't have a, you know, blackface logo. The Cleveland Indians logo was really despicable, I thought, you know, and I think these changes are necessary.
Were you surprised?
Yes and no. Not terribly surprised.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that this all seems to begin with, of course, the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer. It certainly then had Black Lives Matter movement. We've now had a whole series of discussions again about taking down Confederate statues. And now we have this, which is the renaming of the teams. Is there an awareness that's coming about? Is this an inflection point of the country trying to come to grips with its past, or how do you read this moment?
Yes, I do think the country's coming to grips with its past. So when I wrote the book, Original Politics, I was looking for the sacred purpose of America. And one of the things I found, you know, is that American ideals are founded upon Native American values, liberty, justice, equality, inalienable rights. These things basically didn't exist in Europe that was under monarchies at the time. A lot of people credit that to ancient Greek democracies, and there's some semblance of truth to that, but most of their influence came from Native American living societies that were truly egalitarian. But the Founding Fathers only took what they wanted to take from Native America, so they left out women, who had a very important, integral role in the political process. They obviously left out people of color. They never dealt with our original sin of slavery, even though many of the Founding Fathers were morally or philosophically opposed to slavery, including Thomas Jefferson. I mean, he wrote about that, but he also had 600 slaves. So in not dealing with that, we created a shadow. And basically, Donald Trump has been a catalyst for the revealing of the American shadow. So you're right. There is a revealing, and there is an awakening of consciousness that is happening now. And I tell this story in the book, and it's a White Mountain Apache story. It's of an old woman who's weaving a beautiful rug. And as she nears completion of the rug, she gets up to stir a soup that's on the fire. But while she stirs the soup, her black dog, who's been sleeping in the corner, awakens and then takes a hold of one of the threads with its mouth and pulls and pulls and unravels the whole rug. And the woman returns. She's unfazed. She doesn't get mad at the dog. She stares into the rug, and where there was beauty and harmony, there's now chaos and disorder. But she picks up a loose thread, and she stares in the rug long enough until she reimagines a new way to reweave the rug in beauty and harmony, maybe even more beautiful and more harmonious. That's where America is today. Obviously, Donald Trump is the black dog that stirred everything up and unraveled everything. And it, but there's both danger in that, a lot of danger, because he's given a license to certain forces to come out of the shadows. But there's also an opportunity to see America as it really is, and then to make substantive change. That's really one of the main points that I'm making in my book.
One final question about what's going on today, and that is that it seems to me that certainly when I was growing up, the country was defined, particularly in terms of Native Americans, by what was then classically the Western. There were dozens of shows, television programs, that kind of thing, depicting the West in one particular way. Do you think that we're now moving away from that, that we're not going to see that kind of thing again, or do you think that might pop back into popular culture?
I don't know. I think that in general, the trend has been more positive in Hollywood. If you look with a big, broad brush from the gross stereotypes that happened in the John Wayne movies and stuff, then you had Dances with Wolves come in with Kevin Costner. And even though Kevin Costner is the main character, a white guy, and there's Mary McDonnell, who plays Stands with a Fist, in Dances with Wolves, the natives talked in their own language, you know, so that was a good improvement, you know, and it was realistic in that regard. And then after that, there's a whole movement, actually, for Native American cinema, you know, and I think you probably know the movie Smoke Signals. I mean, that movie is now, I think, 25 years old, but that really catapulted an enormous movement of great Native filmmakers, Georgina Lightning. There's many, many, many good Native American filmmakers. In my previous organization, Seed, we did it. You know, at the time, it was the largest Native American film festival in American history in 2008. So I know some of them. Yeah, they've changed the face of cinema, and hopefully that will come into Hollywood more and more. So I do think it's opening up.
I want to turn to the revolution, the beginning of the nation. And you begin actually with Edmund Burke versus Thomas Paine. Describe for me sort of briefly the differences between those two in terms of their approaches of governance.
Well, you know, there's been a lot written about Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine because they really are the progenitors of the modern term right and left, which come from the French Revolution. You know, those that sat to the right of the monarch were in favor of the monarch. Those that sat to the left were protesting. And so Thomas Paine is this idealist, and he really wants to remake things. You know, he thinks if you have a government that is not beholden to the people, they should be thrown out. He's for revolution. He's one of the people that stirs up the revolution in America. He's one of the people that buffets people's morale during the revolution. And he then goes on to stir up the French Revolution. And he thought that Edmund Burke would support the French Revolution because Edmund Burke supported the American Revolution. And he went over to England to see him, and they had dinner together, and was surprised that Edmund Burke did not want to support the French Revolution, and goes on to write the book Reflections on the Revolution in France, that also was a very big bestseller. The two of them had this, what's called the War of the Pamphlets. They both wrote these incredibly big best-selling books. But the difference between Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine than today is that back then, people would read both. you know. Today, I don't think there's very many people that are reading a book by Chris Matthews and then another book by Hannity, say. they just speak to totally different audiences, and the two never meet or talk or dialogue. And in my view, liberalism and conservatism, the classic forms of them really, are two aspects of one whole. That's the way I approach it. You always need liberal progressives pushing for change, because otherwise you would just be stuck in inertia. And you also, perhaps, always need conservatives who sometimes tap on the brakes, hopefully intelligently. And in the end of the book, I really make the point strongly that conservatives ought to conserve. They ought to conserve the environment. That's my most important point. And that happens in Europe to a large degree, but hasn't really happened as much in America, where we have a little bit different mindset because we were land of so much acreage. So we've kind of gone, the conservatism in America has gone more the laissez-faire capitalist route. But that needs to change. It has to change. And it wasn't that long ago, in the 1970s, under Richard Nixon, oddly, although he did veto the Clean Water Act, that's when the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts are passed and when the Environmental Protection Agency was started. But now it's so twisted in the Trump administration that people trying to protect the environment are suing the EPA. That's how what California's been doing.
Right.
There you have it, yeah.
So I want to turn to the Iroquois and their influence on how the government was created in terms of the ideas that they seem to transfer to the founders. What kind of correlation do you find between them and how they conducted their business and how the founders began to set up the government for the United States?
Well, there was an enormous correlation. A lot of people may not know, but Chief Canasego, the Onondaga chief, is the person on July 4th, 1744. It's interesting that it's on July 4th. On July 4th, 1744, 32 years before the Declaration of Independence, he makes a speech to a gathering of the colonies and urges them to unite like the Iroquois Confederacy has. See, the Iroquois Confederacy or the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee means people of the longhouse. That's the word they use for themselves. Iroquois came from the French, but still today, I use both in the book because my purpose is communication, and I may use both while we're talking. But that the Iroquois Confederacy is very old, by some estimates, 1132 A.D., and at that time, they were warring amongst themselves. And in their story, a peacemaker, they call him Peacemaker. He has a name, but they think it's too sacred to say it out loud. And the peacemaker comes in. He's not from one of these tribes, but he urges and promulgates this great law of peace. And through this story, he actually gets the colonies to unite. I almost want to tell the whole story, but maybe I'll just shorten it to just say that there was one Onondaga man, Tadadado, who was considered evil. He had like Medusa, snakes coming out of his hair. And for Peacemaker to convince him to accept peace, he actually does an interesting thing. He gives him more responsibility. He makes the Onondaga Nation equivalent to like the executive branch. Later on, this plays an important role in American history. So this great law of peace is how the Iroquois functioned, and it was documented by wampum belts. Later on, in the true founding document of the United States, Ben Franklin uses the great law of peace to create the Articles of Confederation. It's almost exactly like what was done in the Iroquois Confederacy. In the Iroquois, there was a council of 48, and I think it's 50, or I might have that reversed, but it's the difference of 50 and 48 that Ben Franklin creates this legislative council. And here's something that may freak out some of your listeners. There actually were presidents before George Washington. There were 8 of them. They only served one-year terms, and much like a chief of the council, the chief derived his power from the tribe. It wasn't that the chief was super powerful. The chief derived all his power from the tribe, and the council would weigh in on things. And that's the way we began our nation. For, you know, when they teach history, they teach about the Declaration of Independence, they teach about the Constitution as if nothing happened in between. But, you know, in 1781, France and Morocco recognized the United States as a country, and we had the Articles of Confederation ratified, and they were in existence until the Constitution was ratified. And during that time, we did have presidents who served one-year terms, and they had no power, really, like modern presidents. So they should be distinguished. They're totally different groups. But it was only because Alexander Hamilton and Madison wanted the executive to have more power that they changed in the Constitutional Convention. Check this out. Under the Articles of Confederation, everybody serving worked for free. Nobody received a salary. Nobody received any emoluments or gifts or extra gifts of any kind. And some of that was retained in the Constitution, but a lot of it was jettisoned. And I think it's because the founding fathers were very young. They probably saw a career in politics. You know, Hamilton was 28 and Madison was 32 at the Constitutional Convention. They didn't want to give up work for free.
Well, it does seem to me, following on to that, as you move to the U.S. Constitution, the thing that strikes me the most is the fact that the Articles of Confederation really, exactly as you say, depended upon the states, which I guess is sort of the various tribes, and they just didn't want to step up to the kind of responsibility that that was needed. And so they moved to the U.S. Constitution, which has a much obviously stronger central government, although still limited in many ways. And I've always said that when people talk about the U.S. Constitution as limiting the federal government, it actually was designed to strengthen it. Is there a comparison then between what we finally got and the kinds of elements that you point out were within the Iroquois group itself? Because I think you indicate that there are various roles that various tribes and so on played, and that seems to get reflected in the American experience.
Yes, there is a lot of parallels. And thank you for asking that question, because I don't want to imply that it was only the Articles of Confederation that was modeled based on the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Confederacy, because in remember what I was saying before about the Onondaga branch being essentially equivalent to the executive branch? Well, that was true. That was true. But they also, originally there were five members of the Iroquois Confederacy. They actually brought in a sixth, the Tuscarosa. But originally they also had something equivalent to what we now have in the House of Representatives. They had the Cayuga and the Oneida were considered the younger brothers. And the Seneca and the Mohawk were considered the older brothers. So, when something came to be considered in terms of decision-making, they have these assigned roles. The Onondaga are like the fire keepers. They're the executive branch that oversees the entire process. They can veto something that the younger brothers and older brothers propose. But if they vetoed it, but the younger brothers and older brothers came back to it, and they all were firm in their resolve to have it, then the veto was overturned, much like we have today. When they would reach, you know, so it's, things would start with the younger brothers, just like many things start in the, at the House of Representatives and then go to the Senate. And when they reach consensus, then it's presented to the Onondaga. So all of these things very much are modeled in a way that was recognized under the Reagan administration. And I have to give credit here. I have to stop and give credit because there are many scholars that I was standing on the backs of when I wrote Original Politics, Making America Sacred Again. Bruce Joe Hansen, 35 years ago, was doing his doctoral dissertation on the influence of Native America on the founding of the nation. He's the author of a book called Forgotten Founders. Many other people, Stephen Sachs, Donald Grimd, and also Native people, Orrin Lyons, John Mohawk. Orrin Lyons is still with us. He's 90 years old, and he's a very impressive Native elder, the faith keeper of the Turtle Clan. They all have been talking about this, and in the 1980s, they had an academic convention about it, and under the Reagan administration, there was, on the 200th anniversary of the founding of, or the signing of the Constitution, they acknowledged the Iroquois explicitly as one of the true sources of the ideas that brought this nation together. So it's there. Yeah.
What a turn to, by the way.
I forgot your question.
That's okay. you did answer it. Well, let me ask you this, by the way. So I want to turn to the women's movement, the suffrage movement, obviously, which leads to the Equal Rights Amendment, the voting, and so on and so forth. And you write that the women's movement had a lot of Native American influence as well. I think you even have a passage that you, from your book you wanted to read.
Yeah. See, that's very important. That's very important. And that's something that I have not said yet in this interview, but the women had enormous power. I think I did allude to it. They had enormous power. They nominated in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, but also in other tribes, women had enormous political power. But under the Haudenosaunee, the women were the wisdom council. It took two-thirds of the women's clan to go to war or to make a treaty. The women nominated the male chief and had the right to remove him by taking off his deer antlers, which is the symbol of authority, if that man committed malfeasance of any kind. The women were fully equal in their society. This was not the case in amongst American women. When I say American women, Euro-American women. And in fact, the women's movement of the 19th century, and there have been women's movements all along, but women's movements of the 19th century was an enormously important beginning, which eventually led to suffrage for women. But by the way, I do mention in the book, and this might surprise your listeners too, under the colonies, women who were property owners could vote, and also African-American individuals who had property could vote, whether they were men or women. But when the Constitution occurred, the Founding Fathers gave the power to the states to determine the voting process. So they ended up really not just denying the vote for women, but in many cases taking it away from them. Anyway. Yeah, I do want to read a passage. This passage is about how the influence let me just find it here. The influence of Native America on the 19th century women's movement. And because I'm looking at how did the first radical suffragists of the United States, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Matilda Gage come to a vision of equality for women. All these women were living in 19th century America, a time when a woman fleeing a violent husband would be routinely returned to him by police, just as runaway slaves were returned to their masters. How did these women, who lived in a society where they were required to pay taxes, but had no voice in the direction of government, could not vote, could not run for office, lost all property rights once they married, had no right of divorce, and if they separated from their husbands, lost all custody rights to their children, whose oppression was sanctioned by the Bible, with their husbands having the legal right and religious responsibility to physically discipline them? How in the world did these women, who were not even permitted to speak aloud in church, have the courage to ask for equal rights? They did so because they were living nearby Native women who befriended them and showed them another way. These Native women were fully equal in their society. Their responsibilities were in balance with men. Their children were members of the mother's clan, and they controlled their own use of property. The Native women's work was satisfying and done alongside other women, as opposed to the mostly isolated drudgery of the colonial household. And they were responsible for agriculture in addition to the home life. Moreover, the women were understood to be spiritually related to Mother Earth herself, a relationship that ensured respect. In fact, they lived in a society where rape and violence toward women was almost unheard of and severely punished if it were to occur. These Native women happened to be Haudenosaunee or Iroquois, the same group that strongly influenced the founding fathers of the United States, but in truth, they could have been from any number of other tribes with similar traditions of equality for women. And I'll stop there. But yeah.
Let me finally wrap up with the last couple of minutes that we have. Is how optimistic are you about the future of the country, given what we're going through at this moment? I think you refer to Donald Trump as a trickster, an entity that can actually eventually create positive change. Are you optimistic at this point about where we are?
Yeah, I am, but I have eyes open to what is occurring now. We are in an inflection point. We are in a place where America can go in one of two directions. I do believe, as Theodore Parker did, and as Martin Luther King and Barack Obama like to quote, that the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice, but we are in a difficult place. There's no doubt about that. There's a chapter in my book where I talk about fascist America or sacred America, because we are also on the precipice of fascism. It's really a choice between unity and diversity, which I consider the sacred purpose of America, or unity through sameness. That's what fascism always is. It's sameness. So it's through exclusion. And that's exactly what's occurring now. If we embrace more people to become part of the fabric of America and we learn how to live in a harmonious way, I think that is our destiny. But in order to get to our destiny, we have to look at our shadow. And that, I'm very encouraged with what's happening, even after I finished the book with, race relations in America. Look, there's a shift. I mean, white America is beginning to understand the level of systemic racism. But there's another part of my book that really I end on. I talk a lot about the ecology, because that's very integral to a Native American view of the world. In fact, the definition I'm using for original politics would really be politics that includes the natural world. So I contend that we really, in some ways, have to step back from all the melodrama that's happening amongst people and learn how to love nature again. Because if we learn how to love nature, that's our model of biodiversity. Because that's how nature operates, as an orchestra, polysymphonic, you know, orchestra. Everything is happening at the same time. If we can learn to love nature again, we can learn to love each other. And that's really where I come to. If, you know, getting to peace, I also quote the Muskogee elder Marcellus Bearhart, peace is not the absence of conflict. Peace is the resolution of conflicts with love. So that's where I really think we need to be moving toward.
Well, we've been speaking with Glenn Aparicio Perry. He has written a new book called Original Politics, Making America Sacred Again. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
I appreciate it very much. It was very enjoyable to be on your show. Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.